You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman, translated by Matthew Barton, 15 lectures, this is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 17th of October, 1919. Today I want to speak about some fundamental insights of initiation science. And this will provide a basis for our further reflections tomorrow and the day after. Firstly, I want to point to something that lies in every human mind, but is not usually grasped with sufficient clarity. In speaking of such things, we are always starting from a modern perspective, in the sense I have often referred to here, that knowledge and insights hold true for a specific era, and even for a particular geographical region, rather than universally and forever. So, for example, certain angles on knowledge apply to European civilization, while others are relevant to the Orient. Now, I am sure that we are all aware that our knowledge lives between two poles. On the one hand, every person is aware of the knowledge we acquire through sense perception. In a simple, naive way, we come to know the world through our senses. But then we also combine what we see and hear, what we receive through any of our senses. And basically, what science provides in the West is nothing other than a combination of the sensory information available to us. But every person will also feel that there are other kinds of knowledge, and that we cannot possibly be whole human beings in everyday life if we do not add another form of knowledge to this first kind. Besides the ideas we develop through natural perception, and by means of which we explain various phenomena in nature, we also possess ethical ideas, moral ideals, upon which we feel that our actions are based. We allow these ideas to rule and govern us in our everyday life. And surely, every person feels that the one pole of our knowledge, that of sense perception and the rational insights connected to it, for rational understanding is only an adjunct to sense perception, usually does not rise to the level of moral ideas. Moral ideas exist. But as we pursue scientific inquiries, for instance, we cannot derive these moral ideas from our observations of the plant world, of the mineral world, or in any other branch of science. This is the tragic aspect of our time, in fact, that people seek to discover ideas for social action by employing scientific methodology. Healthy common sense can teach us that we can never succeed in this. Moral ideas exist in a different sphere of life, and our life really is subject to the sway of these two streams, of natural perception on the one hand, and of moral perceptions on the other. If you have read my title, Philosophy of Freedom, you will know that the highest ethical ideas that we need as human beings can come to us by grasping moral intuitions, and that these ethical ideas, once we possess them, are the foundation for our freedom. On the other hand, you may also know that certain philosophers highlight a kind of gulf between natural knowledge on the one hand and ethical knowledge on the other. The philosophy of Kant is based on this same gulf, this abyss, which it cannot completely bridge. This is why Kant writes a critique of theoretical reason, or of pure reason, as he puts it, in which he engages only with the knowledge of nature, with what he has to say about this knowledge of nature. And on the other hand, he offers a title Critique of Practical Reason, where he writes of moral ideas. We can say that he sees all human life as springing from two separate roots, each of which he describes in his two major critiques. Now, it would, of course, be a poor outlook for humankind if there were no bridge connecting these two poles of our inner life. If we give serious attention to spiritual science, on the one hand, and to the challenges of our time, on the other, we are inevitably led to ask where this bridge between moral ideas and natural ideas can be found. In this lecture today, in relation to discovery of this bridge, I will start from what I will call an historical perspective. From our reflections here, you will know that in ancient times, people had a state of soul and sensibility that was different from what it later became. The emergence of Christianity really represents a deep incision in humanity's whole evolution. And only if we understand what emerged and developed in human evolution as Christianity arose, can we begin to understand human nature at all. Before this emergence of Christianity, we find, if we overlook Judaism, as we mentioned here recently, the whole scope of pagan culture. Judaism was, after all, only a preparation for Christianity. This whole pagan culture was very different in kind from our present Christian culture. The further back in time we go, the more we find it to be a unified culture, one primarily founded on human wisdom. I know that people today feel offended if you suggest that the wisdom of ancient times was more advanced than they themselves are nowadays. Nevertheless, it was so. In ancient pagan times across the whole globe, a wisdom existed that lay closer, far closer, to the deep origins of things than our modern knowledge, especially our modern science. And this old, very ancient knowledge was of a very immediate and specific kind, a knowledge deeply connected with the spiritual reality of things. In knowing the reality of things, human beings at that time received something into their souls. An especially distinctive aspect of this ancient pagan wisdom they received passed to them by the initiates of the mysteries, as we know, at the same time contained both natural and moral knowledge. People today overlook this very significant truth in the history of humanity's evolution, only because the outer records of history do not delve far enough back into fully characteristic periods of ancient pagan wisdom. Historical knowledge does not reach far enough back to comprehend times when people, as they looked up to the stars, received from there wisdom which firstly explained to them the course and passage of the stars themselves, but, secondly, also taught them how they should conduct themselves in their lives here on earth. Somewhat metaphorically, but also to a good degree objectively, we can say that in ancient Egyptian and Chaldean culture, people read natural laws from the course of the stars, but also read there precepts governing what they should do on earth. The codicils of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, for instance, contain precepts about what should become law. It is true to say that over many centuries, prophecies were made of what should later become law, and that everything these codicils contained was read from the stars' trajectories. Thus, in those ancient times, there was no such thing as the astronomy we know today, which consists only of mathematical laws of the movements of stars and planets, but instead a science of the cosmos, which was at the same time a science of morality and ethics. The questionable nature of modern astrology, which in some cases is very amateurish, is that it often lacks a sense of the whole, of the laws it identifies being at the same time moral laws. This is a very significant thing, extraordinarily significant. As humanity developed, this primordial knowledge, this ancient wisdom, was largely lost. And to this is due the fact that certain secret schools, which really ended in any serious way at the end of the 18th century, certain secret schools in the West also, continually pointed to a lost science, to what they called the lost word, in quotes. Usually, later followers no longer even knew what had been meant by the word, word. But this was based on a certain reality. And if you read St. Martin, you can still find echoes of what was felt very clearly up to the 18th century, that in ancient times people had possessed a spiritual knowledge they received at the same time as natural laws, and that this contained their moral science too, and that this had been lost already in the 8 centuries preceding the emergence of Christianity. In fact, we might say that more ancient Greek history is largely that of a gradual loss of ancient wisdom. Nietzsche called the pre-Socratic philosophers the, quote, philosophers of the tragic age of the Greeks, close quote. Heraclitus, Thales, Anaximenes, Anaxagoras. I wrote about them in my book titled Riddles of Philosophy, and so far as one can write of them for humanity today in outward terms. If you read their works, you find in sentences that have survived, like oases in a desert, the last echoes of a great comprehensive knowledge and perception that existed in the ancient days of humanity. What Heraclitus says and what Thales, Anaxagoras, and Anaximenes say feels like humanity's loss of memory of its ancient primordial wisdom, with only the odd fragmentary phrase surviving from it. The few sentences that we still have of the works of these philosophers, from the 7 sages of ancient Greece, are like fragments or shards of memory. And then in Plato's works, we find still a kind of clear awareness of this primordial wisdom, while Aristotle transforms this all into external human wisdom. The core of it increasingly vanishes in the works of the Stoics and Epicureans. The ancient wisdom survives only as a kind of legend. This is how it was in Greek times. The Romans, who were by nature a prosaic, hard-headed people, lacked all sense of this primordial knowledge, which they turned into abstractions. That this should happen, loss of primordial wisdom, was necessary for humanity's evolutionary journey. People could never have developed freedom if the ur-wisdom they received by means of their atavistic clairvoyance had remained in them with its original intensity and significance. But bound up with it were all the moral impulses with which humankind had been endowed from divine heights. This had to be preserved. Human beings had to preserve their moral impulse. And among the many things we have already expressed about the mystery of Golgotha is this, that the divine principle descending to the earth through the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, sustained the moral fabric that had gradually been torn to shreds as primordial wisdom faded and died away. However paradoxical it may seem to people today, an ancient wisdom existed, and there's a drawing on page 95, and it was bound up with a human being's moral power, moral wisdom. This was an intrinsic part of it. Now the old primordial wisdom grew dim and could no longer be the bearer of the moral impulse. This moral impulse had, in a sense, to be taken under the shield and protection of the mystery of Golgotha, and there's a diagram on page 97. And it was further transmitted for Western civilization as the Christ impulse that sprang from the mystery of Golgotha, into which was infused a kind of moral essence of the ancient primordial wisdom. It is very remarkable to trace the science, the wisdom, living in Western civilization until the 8th or 9th century A.D. If you look at my title, Riddles of Philosophy, you can read there a brief account of Western knowledge up to that point. And really, there is nothing in this development of thought that we would still describe as knowledge in our own time. This latter-day knowledge has emerged since the mid-15th century, since the time of Galileo, no longer inwardly intuited, inwardly experienced primordial wisdom, but external traditions of knowledge passed down. I have often told you the story about Galileo. It's a true story, not fabricated. Galileo was having difficulty persuading a friend of the truth of something he was stating. Like other people at that time, his friend was used to accepting whatever Aristotle or other traditional authority said. Everything people learned in those days was based on tradition. What Aristotle had written was simply passed on. Well, this learned friend of Galileo believed, with Aristotle, that the nerves proceed from the heart. Galileo was trying to show him that empirically the corpse would tell a different story, that the nerves issue from the head, from the brain. Galileo's Aristotelian friend would not believe this, so Galileo showed him a corpse, pointed to the fact that nerves issue from the brain and not the heart, and expected his friend to believe the evidence of his eyes. But instead he saw that this only, quote, appeared to be true. Appearance suggests that the nerves issue from the brain, but Aristotle, he said, tells us the opposite. And if compelled to decide between the appearance of things, the evidence of his eyes, and what Aristotle says, the man insisted on crediting Aristotle rather than nature. This actually occurred. And in our time, we are experiencing something similar, except it is the other way round. You see, the knowledge in those days was all tradition. New knowledge only arose in the time of Galileo, Copernicus, and such figures. And through these centuries, a moral impetus was sustained by Christianity, was largely bound up with the religious element. This was not the case in pagan culture, where people knew that by receiving cosmic wisdom, they also received a moral impulse at the same time. Then came the middle of the 15th century, with a new impetus which broke entirely with all forms of ancient wisdom, even if the latter had been present still only in the form of tradition. It is extraordinarily interesting to see the fury with which figures such as Giordano Bruno raged at old traditional wisdoms. Bruno really gets furious and lambastes the traditional memory of ancient wisdom. Something entirely new arises. We have to see this new element as a whole new departure, unless we are to relinquish almost all understanding of humanity's evolution. If we indicate the mystery of Golgotha here, and there's a drawing, we can say that the moral impetus continues. So what was sustained from an older time carried forward into a newer era through the mystery of Golgotha in the direction indicated here, and he's referring to the diagram. It was an end. And as we approach these later times, the ancient wisdom fades away, even in the forms handed down as tradition. Though it bubbles on in waves as tradition, something new begins with the 15th century, a new beginning. It is true to say that we are still within this beginning phase. The few centuries that have passed since the mid-15th century have brought us modern science, but nevertheless, we have not yet got far beyond these beginnings. But what kind of wisdom is this? Well, in stark contrast to the ancient pagan wisdoms, it characteristically contains no moral impulse. However much we study these new wisdoms, these Galileo wisdoms in various branches of science, such as mineralogy, geology, physics, chemistry, biology, and so on, we will never draw from this knowledge of nature any kind of moral impetus. It is a great illusion to believe that we can found the social sciences on science. We will never be able to squeeze an ideal for human action from the kind of knowledge of the laws of nature we have today. This knowledge is still in its infancy, and we can only hope that as it keeps evolving, it will come to a point where it can once again incorporate moral impulses as such. But if it were only to evolve in the way so far characteristic of it, this could not give rise to moral impulses. Instead, this knowledge of nature must now also develop a new supersensible knowledge, which can in turn contain the beams of moral will. And when the beginning that arose in the mid-15th century comes to an end, at the end of the earth itself, then supersensible knowledge will be able to flow together with sense knowledge, so that a unity arises from both. When someone versed in ancient pagan wisdom, or someone who acknowledged this wisdom, received it from his mystery initiates, he received simultaneously both natural knowledge and cosmic knowledge, a knowledge of humanity's origins and of morality. And this gave him a moral impetus for his actions. These two were one. Today we must try to see that we gain knowledge of nature from one direction and supersensible knowledge from another. Science as such is void of moral impetus, and the latter must be won through supersensible knowledge. And since ultimately social promptings must be moral in nature, true social insight and understanding, and even just a sum of social impulses, are inconceivable unless we raise ourselves to supersensible cognition. It is important for people today to see that we must take a different path to develop social insight from the one scientific methodology offers. But at the same time, as I say this, I must also point out a curious paradox. I have often said here that the profoundest truths of initiation science can appear paradoxical or strange to ordinary everyday consciousness, and to a confirmed materialist may even seem crazy. But today we need to engage and acquaint ourselves with these seemingly paradoxical wisdoms. In our time it remains true to say that many things humankind regards as foolishness are nevertheless wisdom before God. It wouldn't go amiss if people today who either smile dismissively at anthroposophy or condemn it out of hand were to recall this biblical phrase from time to time. They might realize, then, that what they regard as foolishness might be wisdom before the gods. It would do some people a great deal of good, and by some I mean a very large number, and in particular those who carry their prayer books to church but fulminate about anthroposophy, to study the creeds of Christianity a little more closely and see what they actually contain, rather than arrogantly vaunting their beliefs about it. It really is worth acquainting ourselves today with things that initially seem paradoxical, rather than just dismissing them. For instance, to put it a little starkly, two paths are possible today. We can, for instance, absorb all that the sciences of chemistry, physics, or biology teach us. We can study Darwinian evolutionary ideas with commitment and industry. Studying all this, we may develop a materialistic outlook. It is undeniable that in this process we may become materialists. People today are so quick to pass judgment, and so they become materialists if they identify themselves fully with contemporary views of nature and its laws. But there is another route one might pursue. Besides attending to what is offered by physics, chemistry, mineralogy, botany, zoology, and biology, and all that is taught in these disciplines, we can also attend to actual empirical experiments, can pay attention to how one conducts oneself in the chemistry lab, what one does there, how one studies plants or animal development. You see, Goethe's scientific insights are based on his engaged preoccupation with how others gain their knowledge. The greatness of Goethe is that he did this studying how other people arrive at their findings. It is very illuminating indeed to properly study a treatise by Goethe, such as his title, The Experiment as Mediator of Object and Subject. Here you discover how Goethe attentively observed what happens as the scientist engages with natural phenomena. He very attentively observed what we might call, quote, research methodology, close quote. If you read my title, Introduction to Goethe's Scientific Writings, you will see the magnificent results that Goethe arrived at by studying scientific methods. In a sense, we can continue what Goethe began in the 19th century and apply it to scientific achievements in the 20th, which Goethe, of course, could no longer study. So, as I say, two paths are possible. Let us keep this in mind for a moment. Either we stop with the results science offers, or we also study how people conduct themselves in order to arrive at them. But now, let us consider the human striving for knowledge from a different angle. As you know, besides mainstream science, there is another kind of knowledge, which we can pursue in the form, for instance, of cosmology, anthropology, anthroposophy, insights into human nature, leading to findings such as those I have described, say, in my title, Occult Science. Here we have positive insights concerning the world of spirit. Just as we gain positive insights in science, in mineralogy, geology, and so forth, so we also gain positive insights relating to the spiritual world. It was very important to me, as our anthroposophic movement developed, also to offer positive insights into the world of spirit in the various books I have written. But here, again, we can proceed not so much by arriving at results, but by considering how we arrive at them, how the process can be described, whereby we move from outward to inward observation, how we not only undertake research in laboratory conditions, or in clinical trials, or with a telescope, but also how, through inner soul development, we can arrive at higher spiritual vision by mystical means. This would be something parallel to studying scientific methodology itself, to examining how results are obtained. So we have these two things, a concern with findings and results, and a concern with how we arrive at them inwardly. But now let us hypothetically assume something that will seem a little paradoxical. If we assume that someone like Goethe concerns himself in science chiefly with studying scientific methodology, we will find that he does not become a materialist at all, but comes to acknowledge a spiritual worldview. In modern times, a sure way to overcome materialism is to gain insight into the methods of research used in science. People, in fact, only become scientific materialists because they either do not concern themselves with how they conduct their research or do so insufficiently. They stay with the results, with the findings they gain in the lab, in the clinic, from the observatory. They do not pass on to Goetheanism, to studying the nature of the research they are doing. You see, if you allow the scientific approach to the world, its way of relating to things, of developing knowledge, to work upon you, you become at least an idealist. But more likely still, you develop a spiritual view if you pursue this far enough. But if one tries to avoid arriving at the positive findings of spiritual science, if one finds it tedious to concern oneself with the details of spiritual science, and instead only ever wants to read accounts of how the human soul becomes mystical, if, in other words, one focuses attention largely on the methods used to arrive at spiritual findings, this can be the greatest temptation to become materialistic. The greatest temptation to become materialistic lies in the reluctance to concern oneself with the actual, palpable findings of spiritual science, instead repeatedly accentuating mystical inquiry, mystical contemplation, the method used to enter the world of spirit. This is paradoxical, as you see. By observing natural science, scientific inquiry, we become spiritual. But if we disdain to arrive at real spiritual insights and speak only of mysticism, that is, what is undertaken to arrive at spiritual insights, we will suffer the great temptation of becoming a real materialist. We must know such things today, and we get nowhere without them. For there are, you see, bands of monists today who supposed leaders broadcast a superficial worldview. They compile the external, materialistic results of science into a superficial worldview, which modern people find illuminating, since they do not wish to exert themselves too much. They prefer going to the cinema to anything else, and therefore love a kind of cinematic knowledge, which is what materialism is, rather than something they must elaborate inwardly themselves. These leaders of the monist fraternities thus offer a kind of superficial materialism. They are pests, really, for they spread errors. It is not a good idea to give them oxygen, for they turn people's heads toward materialism. And yet they are less dangerous than another kind, for they are largely honest at least. This honesty does prevent them spreading errors, but at least they are mostly modest and honest, and their errors will eventually be overcome. They will only be of passing importance. But there are other people who systematically and knowingly refuse to lead others to the palpable, positive findings of spiritual science. Indeed, they encourage the modern, rather easy-going and comfort-loving disinclination to engage with the positive, detailed findings of spiritual science. They know that things such as those published in my title, Occult Science, which one needs to study for a couple of years if one is to get somewhere with them, are not comfortable for people today. They may, of course, send their sons to university or college to qualify them as chemists or what have you, but think that a knowledge, a spiritual grasp of the heavens and the earth is something you can get in the twinkle of an eye in one evening's reading. They think a single lecture on the supersensible world should give them the whole span and scope of cosmic wisdom. People find detailed findings from positive spiritual inquiry uncomfortable. There are certain individuals in modern culture who make use of this disinclination to persuade people there is no need to concern themselves with actual positive spiritual realities. They say, for instance, quote, "What's the point of first learning, then talking about higher hierarchies? Why go on about Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, Jupiter, Venus, Vulcan, and so forth? All this is superfluous." Close quote. Instead, they advise people to go deep into themselves, to make their souls mystical, and then they will come to the God within. They teach this, give their followers generalized ideas about how the material world relates to the supersensible, encouraging the disinclination in people to penetrate into detailed spiritual realities. And why do they do this? Seemingly, they wish to disseminate a spiritual outlook, but in reality, they want something else. By this means, they want to properly cultivate materialism. And that is why the proponents of monism are less of a danger, while those who propound mysticism, who talk of all kinds of mystical things, are often the real cultivators, refined cultivators of materialism. They teach some vague way of entering worlds of spirit, but avoid giving details, keep their words very general, and if they are successful, will ensure the world becomes material through and through in two or three generations. Today, the surest, subtlest way of developing materialism is to teach mysticism to those who disdain to engage with positive spiritual scientific findings. Many of the things that nowadays spring up from the soil of so-called spiritual literature cultivate materialism much more vigorously than books, say, by Ernst Haeckel. People find such things very uncomfortable because it makes demands on their capacity for discernment. They dislike this. They would far rather revel in an inner enjoyment of all things mystical. And this is also why there is so much opposition, particularly to honest spiritual endeavors, that disdain to encourage people to dabble in vague mysticism. If you present a spiritual science worthy of the name, you will inevitably meet opposition. And this is because there are numerous people and groups of people today who seek, at all costs, to prevent the true spiritual elevation of humanity. Instead, they make use of the fact that rambling on about vague mystical subjects is a sure way to cultivate materialism. They consciously employ this tactic, and for this reason also they are hell-bent on opposing authentic means of guiding people toward spiritual science. I am referring here to a wealth of literature available today. Anyone who picks up a mystical book today, of whatever kind, will absolutely need to call upon his capacity of discernment. One should not be misled by the fact that a lot of mystical dabbling published today is easy to understand. Naturally, it is easy to understand someone telling you that you need only look deep inside yourself and you will find a God dwelling within, your own God, found only by following your own path, which no one else can show you, since each person speaks of their own different God. You find such things presented in a really extremely seductive way in many books published today. I would ask you to be fully aware of these things. Keep them vividly in mind. For you will only achieve what our anthroposophic movement seeks to achieve by becoming at least a small band of people who really endeavor to develop this capacity of discernment I have spoken of. It would be a poor outlook for humanity if people did not make this effort and develop this capacity. Today, amidst all the confusion and chaos, it is important to stand fully upon one's own two feet The causes of so much of the confusion reigning today are almost palpable in small realities, if we are able to judge them aright. To end, I would like to tell you of one such small reality, which I became aware of just a couple of hours ago, and which is well able to cast some light on the mood of soul and sensibility of people today. My publisher in Leipzig, Altmann, wrote me a letter which I received a couple of hours ago. He told me that an article fiercely critical of anthroposophy has been published in a theosophical journal in Leipzig. Well, this is, of course, permissible. But this disparaging article appeared in the same issue in which my title Calendar of the Soul and my title Appeal to the Civilized World were also published. First, the Calendar of the Soul, then my appeal to the German people and the civilized world, followed by an article fiercely attacking me and disparaging anthroposophy, titled Rudolf Steiner's Appeal to the Instinct of Mediocrity. In such matters, we see some characteristic aspects of the nature of a modern human soul, albeit here in grotesque caricature. It is uncomfortable, of course, to discern the many forms in which such traits appear. Many grotesque contradictions surface not only in such distasteful ways, but are also present everywhere in the life of humanity. Today, it is essential that we develop real clarity, discernment sharp as a razor, if we are to stand our ground. That is the important thing. The end of Lecture 7.